This is Ryan Nilsson sitting with Olga Sandman. It's August 24th, about 1:20 p.m., and we're in Chicago at Olga's house. So we'll get started. Olga, how did you first get involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry?
It was in 1951, and I was a student. I had come from Mexico to Women's College for getting my degree on religious education and missionary work. And during those years, another student happened to be from Guatemala, introduced me to the opportunity of doing summer work for the migrant ministry. And this was here in Illinois, south of Chicago, about 100 miles. That's the first time that I work among the families that had come from Texas to work in the harvest. And an interesting point that some people might not know is that at that time, the camps would be large, 200, 300 people or more, many children. And the migrant families were housed in former prisoners of war camps. During the war that was, you know, in the late 30s and early 40s, they built these camps with barbed wire fences around it, where they held people that were detained because they were German in this part of the country. And later on, the vegetable companies bought those camps to house the migrant workers there.
So you did this first internship or working for the summer. How did you get involved past there?
Well, you know, first of all, the fact that I was Mexican, that I came from Mexico, brought me to very close identity with the people. I had, even if I, you know, I came from a metropolitan area and from a family that valued education very much. Everybody in all my siblings had gone to college and all of that. So we didn't have a lot of opportunity to meet workers like this and to realize that they were considered less. There was a lot of discrimination then, and that they were considered less value because they were poor and because they didn't have an education. That was a jolt. And so, as you can see, there was a lot of learning for me and appreciation for the work that these families did. And trying to advocate for them the way that we knew how to do then, you know, there was no other organizing other than that we serve, the people in the ministry serve as a cushion between them, the workers, and the employers. And these were big companies that grew vegetables like, and then canned. They did not only the harvesting in the fields, but they can and they pack and the vegetables. The ministry at that time was called Migrant Ministry, and it was national. It was related to the National Council of Churches Home Missions Department. And then every state constituted a state ministry, usually supported and financed by the State Council of Churches. And in the summer, seminary students, college students would work in it. We would get a one-week training before going to work and being assigned in teams of about three people per community. Illinois then had 20 to 25 different communities where staff from the migrant ministry would work. And then the local churches were a lot of help and support. It was at that time the migrant ministry was very well received and supported and backed by the local churches and in an ecumenical way and by the church women united, the women. Their name was the same words, United Church Women, but it was the same group of ecumenical women that volunteered on coming to help us, because the programs that we directed in behalf of the ministry and for the families were for children, like daycare and tutorial, remedial schoolwork, recreation, sports. With the families, we had family nights. We interpret. We had sewing circles with the women. We had translating, driving them to doctors and so forth. So we tried to accommodate to the needs of the families in the camp. And I would say that if you gave a rating sheet to the families, they would say, oh, they have an A+. You know, the ministry was very well received. The churches also, like I said, appreciated much the work that we were doing. And that was during the 50s when I came into this work. I graduated the next year, and instead of going home, I obtained an extension to my student visa to work for the second summer. So that was my introduction to it. And I couldn't get out of my mind the fact that these people who came such a long distance, closing their little houses in the valley to work so hard and to get low salaries and all of that, would be treated with so much disregard by most of the population, of course, except for the churches and the people that came to help in the camps. So that was my introduction to it, you know. And when I graduated, I went back to Mexico and worked among the churches in my state. It was actually three states. I formed an association, and I worked in there. But I had met Bob, my husband, during those years when I worked in the migrant ministry. He graduated from seminary, was ordained, and committed himself to 5 years working with the migrant ministry, and became the supervisor or director of the work in Illinois, and then in the winter in Texas and New Mexico. So during those 5 years that he was committed to work with the ministry, we married, and automatically I came back to it. And together we worked, like in Texas, in the area of the panhandle of Texas, where there was a concentration of families that would come from, they had been working in Minnesota and Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan, you know, all the Great Lakes states. They would concentrate in that part of Texas together with braceros. And the braceros were the men that came hired from Mexico on a contract between the two governments. They came to work there. They were men alone. And we work among those families in West Texas. When the second winter that we went to West Texas, we had our first child, and our son was still a baby, you know, younger than 1 year old, and we would take him to the camp. And mainly the men, the braceros, would be so delighted to see the baby because they had left their families at home in Mexico, and they were homesick for them, I'm sure. In the summer, Bob and I would work in Michigan. And it's the same thing, you know, any state, any ministry that you work in at that time, it was the same conditions, very substandard housing, poor pay, a lot of misunderstanding and discrimination and separation of the people from the town. For instance, one of the towns here in Illinois where they would come would have a headline on the local newspaper reminding people, next week is the beginning of migrant work. Make sure to lock your door and don't leave anything in the front yard. You know, put your things secure inside the house. And that was, to me, that was a tremendous insult to the people who had not come to that town to rob or to do anything illegal, but to work hard. And the economy of those towns depended on the work that they did. And again, I repeat to you, that was in the 50s. In the late 50s, Bob and I were working together. And in 1957, he completed 5 years of work with the ministry and took a church in Ohio. So we left the ministry. But I continued through Church Women United. I continued my interest and my support for the migrant ministry. I think one thing that I want to tell you, Ryan, that I consider very crucial to me is that the work that the ministry was doing all those years, it began in 1920, and now in the 50s and in the 60s, was the work that motivated by love of the people, motivated by compassion, motivated by the faith, and simply by the example of Jesus Christ, who was among the poor, who cared for them, and who tried to answer to their needs, and left with us that commandment that we take care of the needs of the poor. Often, in the circles, even of the present-day ministry, I hear people talk about the charity of the ministry, but the inflection of that sentence and what I suspect is behind the motivation of saying that that we have moved from charity to justice is that charity was wrong. And it cannot be wrong. In the theology of the Christians, it's not wrong. Charity is a virtue for the Christians. And if we were playing games with the children, and if we were helping them with tutorial work, or bringing boxes of toys or clothes to the camps that the churches will send, is because that's what we knew what to do, and because it was acceptable. We didn't have any movement for organizing people among us, you know. So I think that we had to be careful on saying it was a progression and evolution of the ministry, and that it wasn't us. I don't think the ministry can take credit for saying we are now a ministry of justice. The door was opened to us by the farm workers. The challenge came from the farm workers, the ones that were organizing. The call, you know, the tugging on your sleeve, join us, we need you, came from them. And we had no way to turn around because that was very powerful. You know, we had already met the people. We had already loved the people and worked with the people. So to me, personally, it was just a natural thing to get involved with what they were doing when they began organizing.
How exactly did that, you're saying the call or the tug of the farm workers, how exactly did that take place?
For me?
Who asked you
for me?
To be involved
yeah.
with a more justice-oriented
yeah.
approach?
Okay. Well, I have it very clear in my mind that one time there was a meeting in Columbus, Ohio. We live in Ohio, a meeting of the Church Women United, the state meeting. And at those meetings, you know, you have 200-300 women that meet, and they have very good couple of days of programs and workshops and speeches and so forth. And as you enter the church, there was a woman behind the table, and that table was full of literature, buttons, you know, lapel buttons, bumper stickers, and all kind of things, and flags. And it caught my attention. It was a colorful table, so I came to talk to her. Her name was Irene Chandler, and I said, "What is this all about?" And she was a farm worker from California at the time when Cesar had sent people around the country to talk to churches and unions and schools and anybody who would listen about their struggle and what was happening in California. And that was my very first introduction. You know, I had so many things to ask her, and I picked one of each kind of things that she had on the table. And I felt like I could have missed the rest of the meeting and stayed talking to her, you know, because she was a woman who had been on the fields and was part of the union and was not traveling around the country to tell people about what was happening in California. And it was news to me that the newspapers and radio and television were not spreading the war at that time, you know. So that was my very first introduction. And at the same time in Ohio, about that time, the Ohio Council of Churches had discontinued the all migrant ministry and had discontinued for several reasons. Number one, because the government now, the federal government, where the war on poverty and some other national programs had instituted state programs like state migrant education, health migrant health, and migrant daycare, and so forth, and channeled the money into the state to run these programs. Now, when the public funds were opening daycare centers, the ones that we had in the basement of a church did not qualify anymore because we didn't have the required specifications that the programs include now. And we had women from the churches coming to take care of the children, but now they had to be certified child care people. And one by one, the programs that the ministry was doing were discontinued. Okay? At the same time, California, because each one of the migrant ministries operated by a state, and the California Migrant Ministry, the staff had become involved in support of the strike and involved with what Chavez was doing. And that, you know, I think it has to be God's hand into all of this, you know. God working through history and through economic changes and through public programs and funds and all of that. And so that's how that woman came to a meeting in Ohio. And not everybody stopped to talk to her. She was not given the platform to speak. She just had a table. But I was one, and I'm sure there were other ones, but I was one that was touched by her and by her message. And that was the beginning. In Ohio then, the Council of Churches had taken the money that was in the treasury for the migrant ministry, which had been discontinued, and gave it to a group of Latino people, and I was one. I was invited to be in that group to begin some kind of program that would help the migrants, because the migrants were still coming into Ohio, but there was no migrant ministry now, okay? And so that was another way of continuing that, because that money and the board that we form, and we call ourselves La Raza Unida de Ohio, you know, the Ohio Raza Unida. And we were operating, trying to figure how, you know, like any other new group, you spend some time spinning your wheel trying to figure what are we going to do and how are we going to do it and where are we going to do it. At the same time, in Ohio, by then, at least 5 years, of Valdemar Velasquez and Flock had been in you know, operating. We had heard about Valdemar. I had never met him, and the reports that would come to me were not very favorable, because when Cesar in California and Valdemar in Ohio began organizing, there are more people against it than people for it. And so the rumors begin, oh, you know, they are communists and they are trying to put the growers out of work, etc. And so I remember being in that group, La Raza Unida de Ohio, where we were not relating to Voldemort. And he, as I understand, didn't think much about us either. However, that was the year, and I'm talking now about 1970, when in the national level, the National Council of Churches, that in a way had been the father or mother organization that started the migrant ministry, the National Council of Churches, the National Church Women United organization, and a few other denominations at that level, at the national level, you know, the Disciples and the United Church of Christ and perhaps the Presbyterian and Methodist, were having a two-year consultation because they knew what was happening in California and they wanted to find out more, and they had organized then delegations to go into southern Texas to see what organizing was being there along the border. And then they had come to Atlanta in 1970 for a two-day or three-day consultation among themselves. What direction were they going to take as a national migrant ministry? I was invited because they invited this La Raza Unida de Ohio to send two delegates, two visitors, you know. We were not members of anything with them. And so we came, David Hernandez, who happened to be the director of that group, the executive director, and I came to Atlanta to see, to listen, and to observe. And one of the things that happened is that Sister Chavez was there. Chris Harmeyer, then director of the California Migrant Ministry, the ones that had already gotten involved with Cesar and his movement, brought Cesar with them. And the deliberation was to the depths of, you know, do we continue playing games with the children, or do we put our resources on supporting Cesar Chavez and the changes that his organization is going to bring for the improvement of the conditions, living and working conditions of the workers. And at the end of the first day, word came to some of us that Cesar wanted to meet with all the Latino people. And we were invited to come to his hotel room. And like I said, that's when I met him. I had never met him before. And we sat with him around his bed where he was resting. He had back problems. Sat with him for hours. It was probably 1 o'clock in the morning when we finally said goodnight and went to our rooms. And I'm not sure whether this is true or it's a myth within me, but I think I was the one that asked more questions than anybody else. I had so many questions for him. He talked to us about the strike. He talked to us about the families and what was a sacrifice that was costing them to them. He talked to us about the marches they were having. He talked to us about how the growers resisted with all their might and all their power and all their dollars the change that they wanted to bring. They wanted to have contracts. They wanted to give some security to the workers, you know, and some benefits that would bring them not only better pay, but some health program and pension and the right to have a break during the day, to have clean water to drink. The basic things that they had never had, they wanted, okay? And seniority was very important, too, because there were people that working there until they could no longer move. Instead of having a retirement or a pension and so forth. So to me, all of those things were fascinating. And down deep in my heart, wishing that sometime eventually will come to the rest of the country, you know. And Cesar will speak in those terms. He said, this is going to be a national union. And our movement is going to be like a fire on the wild prairie, he used to say. It's going to spread. Well, unfortunately, the resistance and the opposition was stronger than to make it happen. But that was a very crucial time for me. I said, that's something that I want to be part of. That was 1970. The decision at that time from the gathered group, the ones that could vote, right, was to discontinue the programs that the migrant ministry had had for 50 years and to put all the resources and effort on supporting Cesar Chavez. Voldemar was present, and Voldemar advocated that he would be also supported with Flock. You know, he was working hard on the Northwest Ohio with the tomato growers, and he himself had grown in the migrant family, you know, coming from Texas. But the group decided that there were not enough means of supporting more than one or the two movements, and they decided to do it to Cesar. Besides that, the California part of the ministry was already involved with Cesar, and that had a great pull into do it that way.
At that point, did you support that decision? Not necessarily the decision to just support the UFW in California, but the decision to end the migrant ministries, because you were saying earlier that you didn't want to underappreciate the charity work of the earlier work of the migrant ministries. Did you think it was
no? First of all, by 1970, when I went to that meeting, and I was in Ohio, so I had to talk on that context. The migrant ministry does not exist anymore. Remember, they had used the leftover funds to help this group that we call the Raza Unida de Ohio to do some work among the migrants. So there was no other way but to say, yeah, if we're going to support. I personally felt very attracted to the idea that the workers themselves were going to bring the change. I did not invent that idea, but I was very attracted to it. It spoke to me very, and even to now, you know, all these years, I have been in the farm worker ministry for more than 40 years, and it still speaks to me with a very clear voice. In other words, if you can use this as an allegory, to have a group of church people sitting around a table, you know, every church has these rectangular tables, and we would sit around a table like that, reviewing how many migrants come in the state, where are the areas where they come, what do they work on, what kind of crops do they work on, where are they coming from, what part of the country are they coming from, what are the needs, and you know, the whole thing was conceived and then executed by the group of people from the churches that sat around the table. Now, without using these words, what the farm workers were saying, they said, you don't need to do that. You don't need to sit around a table and plan for us. We're going to plan it. And it made a lot of sense to me because they knew better than I did what their needs were. And there were needs that were much more deeper and serious and changing, you know, life-changing than the ones that we had perceived. You know, we said they need the children to catch up in the school. They need the children to have a place to play ball, etc. They were saying what we need is to be paid the right wages so that nobody has to bring me their old shoes, but I can buy the clothes for my child. We need the right wages so that I can buy the food for my family without somebody having to give me some food. And that's a very different concept, and I love it. I like it. It attracted me. There were many that had been attracted by that, like the people in the California Migrant Ministry when they said, well, these strikes are not just to make trouble with the growers, but they are to change the way it has been done, the way they are paid, the way they are treated, the type of housing in which they live. I told you, in Illinois, they house them in some places, house them in all prisoner of war camps in some places of Illinois. Voldemar used to tell the story of how the tomato growers in the winter will house their hogs in these buildings. And then in the spring, they got the hogs out, and then they brought the water hose to clean the place, and that's where they put the people, the workers. You know, that's got to change. That's treating people subhumanly. So it spoke to me very loudly, and I know it has done the same to thousands of people in this country, not only from the church, but people from, you know, I'd say that the students, the young people in these generations, in this time of life, the students are perhaps more open because they, even the children, you know, they know what's fair and what's not fair. Like the Yaya people, you know, they know what's fair and what's not fair. They might not get into big discourses about justice and theology and all of that, but they say that isn't fair that these people are treated like that. It isn't fair that, and they said, we'll do something about it. So that was my first introduction, okay? In 1971, as I remember, it was May 1971, the new board of the National Farm Worker Ministry, because at that meeting in Atlanta, the name of the ministry changed. And I remember, I didn't have a vote, but I had a voice. And I remember advocating for the change to be farm worker ministry, to be in more aligned with what they call themselves, United Farm Workers. They didn't call themselves United Migrant Workers, United Farm Workers. And you know, the funniest thing is that through all the years that we were close to Cesar Chavez before his death, he always called us the migrant ministry. He never changed to say the farm worker ministry, the migrant ministry, because that's the way he had known, you know, from before that we turned, that's the way he knew the group, the migrant ministry. And so the year after the Atlanta meeting, they convocated, they gathered the board of the National Farm Worker Ministry in La Paz, which is the headquarters in California, close to Tehachapi and Bakersfield, the headquarters of the United Farm Workers. And we gathered there. One of the buildings was an old hospital. That had been a hospital and grounds for tuberculosis patients. And of course, now it was cleaned up. It had been empty for many years before the United Farm Workers moved there. And we slept there and we gathered there, the first meeting. And at that time, then I was representing this Raza Unida de Ohio. But since it wasn't an organization well constituted, then I came in as more like a member at large that we were talking earlier, you know, member at large. The new constitution, the new bylaws were formed in those years. And then later on, I was representing the Ohio Council of Churches. The focus of the ministry, and it still is, was to be as close, physically as close as we could, where the workers were doing something. And that was California, of course, and some in Florida, because the United Farm Workers were in those years organizing the workers and the citrus that would harvest the oranges that were processed into juice, and it belonged to Coca-Cola. So they were looking for a contract with Coca-Cola, and they got it. They got it. And so we would go to Florida too, you know, in the very early 70s. But most of the meetings were in California. And so going to the meetings where the workers were doing something, we had the opportunity, and since I'm talking for myself, I had the opportunity to be in some of the marches that they would have, to be at their conventions, you know, the conventions, and to be at meetings they had, the workers with Cesar. And it was very impressive to see the way that they communicated with each other. You know, Cesar would give priority to talking to the workers that wanted to talk to him than to talk to the visitors that were representing the nominations or government people or anything like that. To me, one time I heard him say, you know, the hard times were our best times. The hard times when the opposition was so strong. The public was being fed the image of a man who was a communist. And he used to say, well, I don't know why they want to give the communists the credit for doing all the good that we are doing, you know. It was a revelation to see, as he built that union, and the way that the workers were coming to the union, to him and to the union, that because there was a board, a national board of the union, asking, we want to be organized too. And of course, this work began with the grapes, with the strike with the grapes in Delano, California. In California, valley after valley, there are many different crops and different groups of workers that were anxious to be organized. And for many years, the emphasis was on the grape workers. But, you know, they also had contracts in some other crops. And after his death, I think, there was more openness to go in different directions and organize, because they went through three boycotts of grapes. And to us, that were out in the different parts of the country, you know, not only Ohio, where I worked so hard to build support and to gather support to boycott in front of the stores where we were boycotting grapes and then lettuce and Gallo wine, you know. We would do it. I was a recruiter for much of it in Dayton, Ohio, we live at that time, of seminary students, college students, church people to go in front of stores and leaflet and to carry a sign, you know. And I remember the first time I did it, I didn't want anybody to see me. I stood in front of a grocery store in my neighborhood hoping that none of my neighbors would come by, or that nobody from the church will come by and see me doing being in the picket line. Well, that didn't last too long. One of the good lessons I learned, and being involved with the farm worker ministry has been like a continuous going to school, you know, always learning. One of the good lessons I learned is that the public at large were very supportive. That 9 out of 10 people were very open to say, tell me more about it. And yes, I will go there and I won't buy grapes. And we will ask them to go the second step and tell the manager that they would not buy grapes and why. And occasionally somebody would come out and tell us that, you know, go to where you came from and so forth.
Do you think that's changed over the years?
Yeah, well, it has changed to the point that many of the causes surge in American society. And for instance, we worked so hard with the first boycott, and Cesar has sent people to the cities around the country to work on it, you know, and they did a tremendous work. We would be helpers of what they were doing, because they were farm workers themselves, and they had come from the areas where they were organizing to convince people of what was happening, to ask support. And it was very successful. There were, at one time, there were 17 million Americans boycotting grapes. And things marched good because in that area where they got contracts, the pension plans was instituted, the health plan was instituted, seniority was functioning. You know, there were many, there were branch committees that oversaw the contracts and so forth. But then it came the time when the Teamsters intervened. And I don't think they intervened because they wanted to, but they were called by the growers to come. And what's called, you know, I forgot the term they used, but they went, you know, in quotes, they went to bed together and they signed the contracts behind the workers. The workers did not vote to be represented by the Teamsters, but they gave the contracts to the Teamsters. And, of course, then Cesar and the union went on a strike again and a second boycott of grapes. And people like me that were in Ohio at that time found it a little harder to recruit people for the boycott for the second time. It was like, well, we already worked on that and it was won. How come we're back into it? And when it happened for the third time, then at that time there was the Vietnam War, or there were the, you know, anti-nuclear movement. And a lot of the young people that had put on time and effort working on the boycott were not too busy on these other issues, you know, mainly peace. They were too busy, and it was very hard to get the troops into it. I think also the laws, you know, that were passed to counteract the boycott were that they could not do secondary boycotts. That if they were boycotting a product, they could not go in front of a store that was not the owner of the product and boycott in front of it, you know. They got many restrictions where we could be outside the door of a store handing leaflets. Now it was not allowed. You had to be on a public place like a sidewalk. And sometimes the sidewalk was far removed from a store that was in a shopping area. So some things, you know, and people, you cannot hope for society to be 100% all the time. Things change through the years. And all of that, the support, I think the support and the respect that people in the churches, like in my denomination, the United Church of Christ, for the legacy that Cesar left is real, is true, is strong. We celebrated in 2003, we celebrated 30 years that the United Church of Christ being in General Synod, which is our national meetings, biennial, receive a call from Cesar saying, we need you send some people to be with us in the Coachella Valley where the Teamsters had taken the contracts, and it was a very, very difficult time. And there were many in the church who, you know, it's a representative body. All the state conference had sent people to the synod. And the representative and the group was saying, let's take an offering and send them money. They need it to feed the people, et cetera, that are on a strike. And the answer from him was, we don't need money. We need people. We need people to come see what's happening to us. And eventually the synod agreed to charter a plane and send 95 people from all the states in the country to Coachella, and they were there on kind of on a 24-hour trip, and they saw the violence against the workers. They saw the climate of harassment that the Teamsters had created in Coachella. They saw the suffering of the workers, and they came back and witnessed to the gathering of the National Church, and we celebrated 30 years of that, and we had all the presidents of the unions said in our meeting in 2003. So that commitment is real, is true, and is enduring. But the popular thing of gathering the people in the meetings has faded. The other thing that I want to share with you is that there was a separation between Flock and the United Farm Workers for a while after that meeting in which Flock, in a way, was rejected by the church. And Voldemar continued organizing, and then there was a time when Cesar himself made the overture towards Flock, you know, of cooperating with each other and saying, you know, send people to La Paz and we'll help train them, you know, people to work on a boycott. Because at that time, Voldemar had in Flock where began a boycott of Campbell's Soup Company. And that was a tough one because Campbell's image was the good, you know, good, the soup. And if you look at the commercials of Campbell, is that when the child is sick or when the husband not feeling good, you give them soup, Campbell's soup, and then everything is fine. And Voldemar then instituted the third party organizing. He says not only the growers that grow the tomatoes, but Campbell's is dominating the whole industry of the tomato, and the growers themselves have very little power. And that boycott lasted 6 or 7 years, and we worked so hard on it. And because I was in Ohio and I got involved very closely with Voldemar and with Flock, and I admire the work. He's been persistent and faithful. And one of the things that in my life impressed me so deeply is a march that 100 workers, men, women, and children from Flock, made from Toledo, Ohio, to what's the name of town where Campbell's is in New Jersey. You know, it was across the mountains and into Philadelphia. And I flew to Philadelphia when they had walked all of that length. It took them about a month, and it was during the month of August. And they had a tremendous meeting by the Independence Hall. And then we marched with them across into Camden, New Jersey. Camden, that's the headquarters of the bishop in that diocese had told the priest not to get involved with this group because Campbell was a great contributor to the churches, right? But financially. But most of the priests disobeyed. And when we arrived with the workers, we arrived into the church where they were going to meet. The priests, it was about 12 of them, were waiting for the workers with a towel around their arm and a basin of water to wash their feet. And the rest of us were all singing the colores. And Ryan, there was not one dry eye in that church. That was a standing room only. It was so powerful, so powerful. Just like Jesus had done it with the people and washing their feet, now the priests were kneeling down, washing the feet of those people that had walked all that distance, you know. And eventually the boycott was won. A great agreement came about. And Flock and Voldemar have done a great job of organizing and getting under contract all the pickle industry, and they are now working with the tobacco workers. To me, it's kind of sad to see that in California, where the big gains were done by the union, including a law, the first and only Agricultural Labor Relations Act, that things have slipped back into what they were 40 and more years ago, you know, where they are still suffering with workers that don't have water, and in three digits hard weather, not a place to rest under the shade, and they get dehydrated, and some of them collapse and die. There have been five, six, or so many workers that have died. That's very sad to me. It's too hard a reality to accept that after all those years of organizing, things would still be that bad. And of course, they need support. They need great support. Now, along in the horizon comes the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And for us people in the ministry, they are in Florida, as you know. And I think in the late 90s, our board was meeting in Tampa. And a group of workers from the Coalition of Immokalee, which is in the southern part of Florida, southeastern part, southwestern part, they came to visit with us and to talk about their struggle. And I remember so clear they were saying, what we're looking for is a dialogue with the growers. And these are corporate growers, big tomato growers. We want a dialogue with the growers. And we want to ask them for 1 cent more per pound of tomatoes. There were some people in our board, I'm talking about the National Farm Worker Ministry Board, there were some people that came back to them by saying, haven't you heard about Cesar Chavez? Don't you know that you can have a boycott against those growers and that the boycott is the way that you can get some results? And to me, it was like a stab on my heart. And I remember saying at that meeting, do we believe on self-determination or don't we? Where do we get by telling them what to do? They had to find their own way. And if they made a mistake, they had to go over and review it and determine. And look at the way it's happened, you know? Because Florida is an anti-union state, they were not looking for a contract as a union. They were not looking for a boycott a year or two after they began work. They wanted to meet with the employers. And those employers never gave them the time of day, you know. They eventually came up with something very similar to what Voldemort did. Go to the third party. Who is buying the tomatoes? And you know the story about the Taco Bell. And then McDonald's. But when you have the fast food industry, one by one, have come to the table with them, that is not a small thing. I admire the coalition because for 10 years or 10 to 15 years that they've been working, they have been persistent. They are so determined, and they are, most of them are young, and they are a lot of vitality. I see them, you know, that's the way I see them. They are spunky. Even the way they make signs, they don't make a rectangular sign that says anything about them. They make it in the shape of a tomato. And when they were working against the Taco Bell, the sign might have the shape of the Chihuahua dog, and so forth. They built a papier-mâché Lady Liberty that was maybe about 12 feet high. And they used to carry that on the back of a truck where they marched from one town to another in Florida. The Smithsonian Institution caught sight of it. And they came and pleaded with them to let them take the Lady Liberty to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. But the coalition didn't want to part with it. But they eventually agreed because they were told, you know, this is an expression of how the immigrants want to be part of being a free people and find your way. And so it is in Washington, D.C.
That's great. I have a couple more questions mm-hmm. I want to ask, and we don't have a whole lot more time. So you talked about, I'm curious as to how your faith and your beliefs have informed and impacted your work. And you talked a little bit about, with the earlier work of the ministry, how it seemed a direct, it was kind of what Jesus would do. But you've also expressed this deep value for the self-determination. And I don't know if it's a more of an empowerment model or...
It is.
If you can just comment on
sure.
more of how your beliefs and your faith have informed that perspective
mm-hmm.
as well.
Right. You know, I think our faith, the Christian faith, is like a multifaceted jewel that serving people directly is only one side of that jewel. And advocating for them, for them to empower them, is another side. Thanking God for them, not only for the work they do on the fields, but for the things that we have learned from them, is another side. And on I could go talking. I myself find great value to the farm worker ministry to be in friendship with them. They have accepted us. They trust us. They have shown it in many ways when they said, you know, Cesar did it, Voldemar will do it, Arturo Rodriguez said it too. The coalition, Lucas Benitez and those people, all of them, I have heard them say on different occasions and in different ways, we could not have done it without you. Sometimes I wonder if that is giving us more credit than we deserve. But they do feel they are grateful to the church involvement, to the people that come from the faith community, in name of the faith community. And Ryan, I want to tell you something. We are very apt to say the people of faith, and that's you and I, and the people in the ministry. And I disagree with that. In fact, I never use it to say the people of faith are with you or the people of faith, because the farm workers themselves are people of faith, and they are sometimes stronger than us, you know? When we have problems, we have many avenues and networks to solve them. We can get on the phone, or we might have some savings, or we have friends that are in position to solve the problem that we have. The farm workers don't have those resources. And so when they have a big problem, they always turn to God and say, oh, God, help me. Okay? And the ones that are very Catholic, to the Virgin, or whatever expression they have. But their faith is alive within them, on the trust to God. And to me, we that have watched that and witnessed to that faith, it helps me, it fits me, you know. And I have always said that being involved in the farm worker ministry, because I'm not in connection with the workers unless it was for the ministry, okay? Because our board always goes there. Some of them get a little closer, you know. There are some that have stayed here in my house, or there are many different ways in which we have identified with each other and love each other. But our richness to our life that has come from being part of the farm worker movement is because the ministry has opened the door for people like me, so that we are in contact with the workers. And that has fed my faith, you know, tremendously. I think I have, one thing that we have learned is to not only to pray that the workers might be helped and blessed and they receive what they deserve, but to put, the Lord is used to say, the Lord is worth to put feet on your prayers, you know, that walk in the picket line, being on a march with them, going to where they are. That is a dynamic that comes back to me. And, you know, one thing that you don't have to use on this, I'm going to say it, but you don't have to, you can edit, is that About 10 years ago, I received an honorary doctoral degree from Chicago Theological Seminary. I never was a student at the seminary, but I have been a student of life and faith in action and ecumenical work and translating God's love through me to the farm workers and from the farm, through God from the farm workers and to me, that the seminary felt that they wanted to grant me that distinction. And I have said, well, you know, some people go to the classroom for many years to learn. I have been involved with the farm workers, and that has been an education. That has been an education. Now, present day, I'm 84, and both the physical stamina is not the same, you know. So I have slowed down in many ways, but I'm still active, in, both in the ministry and with the farm workers, you know, whenever they need us. But at the same time, I am of the conviction, I'm not the only one, but I'm of the conviction that we who have been in the movement for a long time can move a little to open the door for the young ones. And the hope is some people like you, some people like the Yayas, you know, these people that in a way they are blessed because I think society has opened more to issues, you know. They are not as rabidly against organizing. And if more people don't support things like the ministry and the organizing of workers, it's because they are too spread into so many other causes. Or the financial resources don't go that far. But I think that there are a lot of people in this country that recognize that what the farm workers have done is a nonviolent war to defeat all of this injustice that the farm workers have lived with for so many years.
So what would you like to say to people who are interested or might be interested in getting involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry today?
Well, I think the talk that you and I have had so far is one way of saying, you know, I think that the farm worker ministry together, you know, one side is the farm worker ministry and the other side of the coin is the farm worker movement, has all the elements to make a nice, challenging, and unique involvement in anybody's life. There's not only the working hard for something that's valuable, putting your principles, your values, your morality, your ethic, and your appreciation of human life all in the same mesh of being involved with the farm workers and in the farm worker ministry. I don't believe most of the people that I talk to are going to take a job working in the fields. So the best is to get involved with the ministry, you know, and get close to what the workers are doing. That's one way of saying it. The other one is that if we as Christians, and, you know, I know that this ministry has wanted to be interfaith. That means have the Jewish and the Muslims and everybody else of other faiths. But we have not been able to get to that point. I hope it is still an open question that will come in the future, okay? Right now, it's basically a Christian ministry. Remember what I began telling you about the old migrant ministry? That was only Protestants. And then when we became national farm worker ministry, we became interfaith. We became the Catholic and Protestant together. And And I would say that as Christians, we have two great lights to look to and to guide ourselves in that direction. One is Jesus Christ. Okay, the kind of man he was, I don't have to tell you. I don't have to tell anybody who is a Christian the kind of life that he said, live it like this, you know? The last shall be first. Don't try to be first. And, you know, all the love your enemy and give to the poor and be with the ones that nobody else wants and all of that. And, you know, I don't have to preach a sermon. You know it, Ryan. And anybody who says I'm a Christian should know it. And if not, go back to your Bible and start reading. And the second light that we have to follow is the prophets. You know, the prophets who were not Christian, but that was the base in which Jesus built so much of his talk, you know, about justice, about let justice roll down like waters, it said in Micah, and Amos, and Jeremiah, and Isaiah, you know, all those prophets were for justice, for the poor, for the people that somebody else was taking advantage of. They said that is not right. And some things that the prophets did is that they pointed the finger at the ones that were in power, whether they were government or they were religious authorities. And he didn't care how important and how powerful they were. They pointed the finger at them. And they said, thus says the Lord. You know, this is what you're supposed to do. And the Lord is saying that to you. If we take seriously our faith and follow those two lights, then we have no choice but supporting the farm workers, joining the farm worker ministry. If you don't join it because you cannot be a member of the board, you know, hopefully, yes, that they can bring their denomination or their group or whatever, but you can at least join it by supporting the farm worker ministry. Financially, it's a very important thing, because financially is what's going to help the ministry to continue the work that they are doing. It's like being the representatives of those that give. I will represent you with your financial assistance in the front line with the workers.
That's great. Is there anything else you would want to add, a story or comment that you would want to share with people?
Well, you know, Ryan, I guess since you promised that you were going to edit, because I've probably given you more than... There are stories like when I was the chair of the support committee in Dayton, Ohio, and we had learned through the news that Senator Dole, who was running for president and who had made a statement, a good friend of Nixon, and had made a statement against the boycott and in favor of the grapes and so forth, he was going to come to a fundraiser dinner where it was like $100 a plate, and at that time it was too much money. It was in the 70s. He was going to come to Dayton. So I got on the telephone, talking to people, and organized the supporters. And about 50 of us came. And we had signs about the boycott of grapes and support the farm workers. And we had flags. And we gathered in front of the hall where he was going to be speaking. The parking lot was huge. And there was like a wide lane in the parking lot in between two sides of cars that we could make our line in there, you know, along the cars of both sides. And when he came with his aides and all of that, he could see us. He could probably read the signs and saw us. You know, we didn't get to talk to him, but we were there witnessing, you know, in support of the workers. and all of that. Shortly after he went into the hall, there comes the sheriff. The sheriff car with the light on, you know. And he came right in between the two lines of protesters. And he got out of the car, and he was the typical big fat guy with a big hat and his big star sheriff and his gun on the hip and all of that, you know. And he shouted, "Who is in charge of this?" And everybody said, "She is," and pointed at me, you know. And indeed, you know, I was the chair of the local committee. There were ministers there. There were the students from the university, the Dayton University. There were all the supporters. There were some labor people, but everybody said, "She is." So he came over and he said, "You get your group out of here, and if you don't, I'm going to arrest all of you." And, but he was shouting. He was not talking, you know. And I said to him, "Under the First Amendment of the Constitution, we have a right to be here and speak and demonstrate." And he said, shouting loud on my ear, he said, "I don't know anything about no constitution. Don't you mention that to me. I'm the authority here and you." And right behind him, with all that commotion, the press had come. They had just arrived. So a couple reporters began taking pictures of the sheriff and said, "Sheriff so-and-so," you know, whatever his name, "would you mind repeating what you said about the Constitution?" No. "What is it that you said that that's not important, the Constitution?" You know. And that took the focus then from us to him. And he was so upset. And he was tongue-tied, you know. He said he just got in the car and drove away. So that's a story that I always remember. You know, we were scared when that happened. It didn't happen that he would arrest us. He said he was going to take me in and all of that if we didn't leave. But so that's one thing. There's another story when one of the early conventions in Fresno, California, Cesar had invited me to open the convention with a prayer. And that was a big privilege, right, an honor. So I was ready to say my prayer. He stood up at the beginning of the convention to open up the convention, and it was supposedly that he would call me to the microphone to give the opening prayer. He forgot. He never called me. So the convention started, and they started talking about different business and things and voting and doing, and then came the time for lunch. And at the lunch time, usually it was a group of maybe 30 or 40 people that get invited to go to a certain room to eat with him. And then they had big dining hall for all the delegates. And Chris Harmeyer said, "Do you know, Cesar, you forgot to call Olga for the prayer?" "Oh, my God," he said, "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry," he said to me. "But you'll open this afternoon with a prayer." And I did, you know. So that was another memorable thing. And then when he was having his third fast, a fast that lasted more than 30 days, and he was in Delano. And this is because he wanted the boycott again of the grapes. And it wasn't happening. I already talked to you about that. And he was in bed. He was very weak because he would not take even juice, you know, just water. And the executive committee of the ministry met there, and we were invited to the room to talk to him, you know, and talk to him for a while. And they had asked me that night, every night of his fast, the workers would come from an area around in the evening after they came from the fields and they went home and showered and ate something, would come for a mass or a service, you know. And they had a big drop cloth in the back of the stage with little wooden crosses one for every day that he had been fasting. And they had asked me to hear the homily that night. And I was, again, it was an honor, and I had prepared for it. But then, unexpectedly, two of the Kennedy children came, or Robert Kennedy came. And it was still before the service, and we went up in front of a store to pick it, and they were with us, you know, chanting and holding signs and marching with us in front of the store. And when we came back into 40 acres where Cesar was staying and the meeting was going to take place, the evening service, somebody said to me from the board, you know, Olga, would you mind if we give your time to the Kennedy children for one of them to speak instead of you? Oh, no, of course, not at all. And so that night, the two, it was a boy and a girl, I forgot now the names, spoke that night, you know, and I was preempted. And that's okay. But that was to see him so weak, almost to the near point of death, you know, it was so sad. And the last thing that I'll tell you about Cesar is that in 1993, when he died, Bobby and I were in Istanbul, Turkey. And it was the second year of our appointment there. So I had several phone calls. That was prior to email. people were not using email. We didn't even have a computer there, a laptop. So I had several calls from family members and from the ministry. Pat Drydeck, who was then the director of the ministry, called me to tell me that he had died. So that was a hard to describe feeling, you know, and in because we had hope, wrong as it is, we had hope that he was going to live forever, right, and see the union being strong and so forth. But he died. And several years later, the ministry went to La Paz for the meeting, and just to pray by his grave was very emotional for not only for me. There was another woman, was a member of the board that also worked for the United Farm Workers for a while in the 70s. That was very emotional to be there, you know. And I have a friend here in the Chicago area who is a musician, and he has written the music and the letters and the songs to a theater musical called Let the Eagle Fly. And it's a story of Cesar and the first boycott and the first strike. And it's so beautiful. It is beautiful. And it has been shown here in the Chicago area half a dozen times. And he has gone to California. It just was shown in Salinas, where there was a lot of organizing there. And he has been in San Jose, where a lot of family of the Chavez, well, he was from that area. And he has been shown in San Diego and in Texas, in San Antonio, and in many other different places, you know. And I'd like to recommend to anybody that would listen to try to see that show, Let the Eagle Fly. And I'm hoping that someday, well, like whenever it's being shown somewhere, and through my friend Julie, I know that it's going to be in a certain location, I contact members of the board of the National Farm Worker Ministry that live close by and tell them, go see the show. And for one reason or another, they all have different reasons for not going. I'm going to be somewhere else, all right? You know, and I regret it. I think they are losing something there by not seeing that show. So I'm hoping sometime the National Farm Worker Ministry would be meeting where that show is, because what we're talking about, those first years when they struggled so hard to build their union and to have the first strike and the boycott of grapes, are right there in that show, and it's beautiful.
Let me know when it comes to North Carolina.
Yes, I will. Well, you know, talk to anybody at Duke that might be in theater or something like that, mm-hmm. and then I can see that they send you information in a video and all of that. Because often it's through universities and colleges that it gets, you know, they had it, what's called the Illinois Valley Community College here in Illinois, west of Chicago, about maybe 100 miles. They had it there in the spring, I think. It's a college that's mainly Swedish people and other local American people. So when Julie went to see the first rehearsal, she called me and she said, Olga, what am I going to do? Everybody's blonde, blue-eyed, you know. And it's about Caesar and his brother and all the farm workers. Did you know that when the time came to present the show, they all had dyed their hair black? All the students, they were the students, you know, from the theater department. I thought that was wonderful. And they enjoy it. They love to be in the show, but they all had dyed their hair black.
That's great. Well, thank you for this time. This has been really good. I appreciate you sitting down with me.
Well, thank you for listening, Ryan. You know, I know that it was kind of rambling, this has been a tremendous experience for me to be part of the ministry and part of the farm worker movement. So thank you for listening.